Market moving insight and analysis. Join Jim Cramer, David Faber, and me, Carl Quintanilla, on the opening bell hour of CNBC Squawk on the Street. Good Monday morning. Welcome to Squawk on the Street. I'm Carl Quintanilla with Jim Cramer, David Faber, coming to you live from separate locations. Futures are red to start a week with a packed calendar, whether that's earnings, inflation data, retail sales, 9 Fed speakers with Powell tomorrow. We will watch reopenings from automakers and, of course, Shanghai Disney. Oil's pretty steady as the Saudis do voluntarily cut another 1 million barrels a day. But, Jim, so much to sort through in the coming days as the Nasdaq's coming off a 5-day win.
Well, look, a lot of the stocks in the Nasdaq are for companies that do better in a COVID era. Remember, we've got many, many institutions with 80 to 95% of people working at home, and they've required a gigantic change in the supply chain of work. And the supply chain of work has just generated a remarkable new wave of the cloud, of hardware, of software. And the companies that are really rallying, for the most part, are companies that do fabulously when you have to create new factories. And the factory is in the home. David?
There's a look at Steven Mnuchin, guys. We're going to talk to him in just a few moments. A lot over the weekend, Jim, whether it was Mnuchin, Hassett, Kashkari, basically prepping us for the idea that the worst of the impact is still to come, even after that jobs number on Friday, which, of course, we didn't have you with us to discuss.
Here we are. Well, I was gardening. I wanted one thing to be normal in my life. Everything else has changed, like for so many of us. I question the notion that this month will be worse. We are hearing too many people who are reopening. And unless there's going to be another outbreak, I just think that these people are being too negative. I don't want to be in the camp which just says happy days are here again. But every single person this morning has talked about a reopening, whether it be Mark Cuban, whether it be Jackson from Auto Nation. I don't know how people think it could possibly be worse. PPP kicks in. So maybe there's something that we don't know that is going to make it so that we stall out again. But I think maybe they're just under-promising and hopefully over-delivering.
But Jim, to the extent that we still don't know what things look like a number of months from now, I mean, that continues to be certainly a conversation that I know you're having, we're all having with right. people in the business world, the nature of work. Your point, of course, so many people working from home. We've seen the big technology companies, Facebook, for example, any number of other ones, who've said to their employees, don't even worry about coming back until next year if you don't feel comfortable. We talked to Dave Gitlin from Carrier on Friday about the assembly line, and he brought up the idea that spacing workers that far apart may require robots in between. I just, you know, you do start to have to think about, well, what is life going to be like when we return to some form of normalcy? It's not going to be the same.
No, it won't be. And I think that the factories are really struggling, whether it be Tyson, where there's just a horrible article about what it was like initially there, initially being not that long ago, whether it be Elon Musk, his rant this weekend, you know, let us go to work. We are not this is the first time I can say this, but unfortunately, we're not a manufacturing country, but maybe it's fortunate right now because they're the ones that can at least put out product. The product is going to be curtailed. I know that we had no autos to speak of sold last month, but Phil's been talking about the incredible resurgence of the truck. And we're not going to look at these and say, you know what, they don't count because there's a huge they make a fantastic deal, basically, with low interest. But it is an issue. And I know, David, you talked about what happens if Hertz goes under. What happens is all those used cars. I mean, because the used cars right now are not that much cheaper than the new cars. So the people yeah. buying the new cars with a financing plan, but we could be deluged with those. Housing's held up. I mean, housing's held up to a point where we don't talk about it enough as a bright spot. Maybe it's because I right. gardened this weekend and saw my wife that I actually have some positive things to say. But I do feel that this relentless, we're going to have a worse number than the Great Depression, which is what Secretary Mnuchin basically implied. I'm not buying it. I'm not buying it.
I get that. I get that. But, you know, you do. I mean, we've talked, of course, as well about those who own commercial space, whether it's for retail or for office space. Again, back to the idea that How, what percentage of a workforce now at a company is not going to be required to show up in the office at all? Efficiencies that, you know, that companies have seen out there, they are now going to seize in the name of, well, keeping people distanced and so forth. But it is also potentially going to help their bottom line to some extent. The question is, who's it going to hurt? There's a lot of economic activity that comes from people reporting into work every day.
Right.
And even when we get back to opening, it's still unclear, certainly in many major metropolitan areas. And I'm talking across the country here,
no,
not just
right.
in New York, where, you know, where it's not going to be returning to a normal level of economic activity.
No, we see it. You can use the ServiceNow and you can use the Salesforce.com. And you can say, you know what? We really don't need any staff. We can have every producer at home and we can let everybody go. They don't talk about that much, but the products are so good that you simply do not need anywhere near the number of people who used to be in the office. They're discovering that. I don't know what happens to those people. I don't know what happens to so many people that are just a superfluous amount of people in this country. After being 3 months ago, everyone was so needed. Now we find that we have to find things for them to do.
Yeah, Jim. I mean, your point on employment, I think, makes sense. Nat Alliance had a note out this morning, and their general point was, you know, we're talking about reopening all the time, but it's right. usually through the lens of retail, malls, entertainment, Disney. You go back to the doctor or get your kids back to the dentist or the orthodontist, and you're talking about a V-shape in at least healthcare visits, teledoc notwithstanding, that is a huge part of GDP. So maybe your point on employment's in the right direction.
I am so glad you brought this up. I'm calling this a healthcare recession. There was a tremendous number of people who've been just taken out. Now, we have the combination of AbbVie today and Allergan. And Botox, the whole idea that dermatologists, who, by the way, who wear masks and have PPE, that they've been sidelined. Well, they're back. Think about the whole chain of people involved in healthcare, in doctors, in dentists. And you know that that was an area that was in depression. That area can start up immediately. Again, I come back to the administration not recognizing the fabric of work in this country and not realizing who is ready to go back, looking too much at factories, old America, and not looking at new America, which is traditionally actually based on healthcare tech. Now, the thing that I am worried about, banking, because, and David, you know this, I mean, how much forgiveness can you give before the REITs just not only give up dividends, but give up themselves?
Yeah, that's a key question. You know, we don't have a full sense yet in terms of May rent rolls, Jim, whether it be retail, where in April a lot of them weren't paying, most weren't paying, and commercial, where most were, we don't know yet. And then, of course, as to your point, it works up the chain to the indebtedness that those owners of the real estate have and their ability to repay the banks and whether there'll be forgiveness there. Guys, another story we've, of course, been watching closely is the reopening, broadly speaking, around the world, and Disney in particular. Those theme parks, of course, still closed here in the U.S., but open in China, at least at Shanghai Disney. Let's get to Eunice Yoon, who has that story for us. Eunice.
Thanks so much, David. Well, there are new rules to be able to get into this theme park. Got to wear a mask, get your temperature checked, and keep a safe distance from each other.
Another sign life is getting back to normal in Shanghai, selfies in front of the Disneyland castle.
After being shut for 15 weeks, Shanghai Disneyland today became the only Disney theme park open for business. But it's definitely not business as usual.
The park is still under post-pandemic restrictions to keep people healthy. The man in charge to do that here is head of operations, Andrew Ballstein.
We always have that space around everybody. They can feel comfortable.
Every line has markers instructing people to keep at least 3 feet away from the next person at entrances and even while on rides like Pirates of the Caribbean.
As our guests are loading in, you'll see we put an empty seat between each group and then also an empty row between each of the rows.
At the park, visitors get constant reminders to keep a safe distance from each other. At the restaurants, entire tables are being blocked off.
All the restaurants, the menus are staying the same, but some of the service styles may be different. So we're not doing buffets. We're going to have a buffet concept, but we actually will serve the food for you.
Hand sanitizer is available at restaurants and stores. Mobile payments are encouraged to avoid passing of cash. Theaters will stay shut. Parades limited. No fireworks to discourage crowds. but you can still see your favorite characters. Just don't get that close. Mickey and the gang are social distancing just like everybody else. No shaking hands or hugging. That has to wait for safer times.
And you may have noticed that Bolstein and I weren't wearing masks during the interview. That reflects some of the loosening restrictions here in Shanghai. But also, we taped that interview before the park opened, and we're sure to stay at least 3 feet away from each other. Back to you.
Thank you, Eunice. Eunice Yun in Shanghai, who I know earlier, had also pointed out, guys, the lines are much shorter. So there is certainly one benefit to having the park far from full occupancy.
You know, I'm so split. There are a lot of people in this country who are anti-mask. It comes so easy to the people in Asia to wear masks. We are 6 feet. They are 3 feet. That's quite a difference when it comes to a restaurant, when it comes to retail. I always want to know, where did they come up with their rules? Who's informing them? Because we obviously are pretty loose on masks, and we're very strong on distance. It is quite an anomaly to see what they're doing versus what we're doing.
Yeah. Really quick, Jim, a J.P. Morgan analyst on Squawk this morning suggested July 1 for Orlando and maybe later for Disneyland, given the disparity between Florida and California policies.
Well, that would be why Disney stock is where it is, because holy cow, that stock was supposed to get hammered. All it's done is go straight up since they reported. So obviously people are getting a little more optimistic. Again, the 25% figure doesn't make sense to me.
All right, we're going to talk to Disney's Bob Chapek later on this morning on Squawk Alley about the Shanghai reopening and a lot more, obviously. And after the break, the Treasury Secretary, so don't go away.
Joining us now is Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin. Mr. Secretary, thank you so much for coming back on Squawk on the Street.
Jim, great to be back with you.
Okay, I want to give you a chance for a do-over. We saw a remarkable weekend. Resurgence in shopping. So many different places and going out. Can we possibly take off the table that next month, the next number will be worse than this one? Maybe leave it open that perhaps we've gotten some improvement?
Well, Jim, I wouldn't say it's a do-over. I said it could be. So I think the economic models are very difficult to predict this situation, since this has nothing to do with normal economic factors. This has to do with a closing of the economy and an opening of the economy. So to me, it's, you know, first of all, let me just say we're very sympathetic to all the workers who this is impacting. And if the numbers are worse next month, you know, we understand that. But I think the numbers are going to be getting better as we go into the summer and we reopen the economy. And that's the important issue here.
Now, we're discovering phase one pretty much being completed. We've got phase two now, which is another whole level. What can we do? What can the government do? How much money should the government spend to make it so phase two incorporates all the new rules, the new safety rules, which turn out to be quite a burden for most of the businesses?
Well, Jim, the really important issue is Congress worked very, very quickly with the administration and the president on an unprecedented $3 trillion package. And we're just getting that money now into the economy. So we are having the second round of the PPP actually being dispersed. We now have over 140 Americans who got direct payments, either direct deposit or checks. We have lots of money going into the economy because of the facilities that the Fed has announced with the Treasury. We've unlocked the bond markets, so you have companies like Boeing being able to borrow unprecedented amounts of money. And I think this is going to have a big impact on helping the economy. And now what the president has said is, let's step back for a few weeks. Let's be very considerate in what we do in the next round before we go consider spending another $1 trillion or more of taxpayer money. But the president is determined we'll do whatever we need to do.
Well, can you tell the president first, PPP, I think, has been a phenomenal success. There were obviously some people who took advantage of it, and you've weeded them out. But at the same time, PPP has unveiled some situations that I think the president really would be great to step into, which is the disparity of states. We've got Elon Musk trying to open a factory And he can't open a factory where really hundreds of people could be employed. Many people in New York are taking what's known as the Tennessee Pledge because we don't know how to open restaurants where we have to whip out half the chairs. We have to, and you have to take somebody's temperature when they come in, ask a series of questions. Boy, would it be great if the president gave us directives about what the White House thinks we should be doing.
Well, the president has given directives in what we should be doing, and we've put out a set of guidelines, and then we're working with the states, and most of the states are all cooperating. I must say, I agree with Elon Musk. He's one of the biggest employers and manufacturers in California, and California should prioritize doing whatever they need to do to solve those health issues so that he can open quickly and safely. Where they're going to find is he's threatened, he's moving his production to a different state.
Mr. Secretary, there's been so much debate around whether or not states that have, quote, been poorly run deserve as much aid as those that, quote, have not. Are there parameters that the White House is developing to determine how well a state's been run and whether that is a factor in ongoing aid?
Well, there's ongoing discussions on this, but, you know, I've heard very clearly from the president and the Republicans that we are not bailing out state pensions and other things. And I haven't heard from the Democrats that they're willing to do it. They want to throw a lot of money at this problem, but I think it's very clear there is not going to be bipartisan support that bails out states from previous problems. And one of the things we did last week at the president's direction, I think it was very important. We gave a lot of money to the states. We created more flexibility. So we said they could use that money for firemen, first responders, and policemen so that in no uncertain terms, the states didn't have to lay off those people because they were having budget issues. We're also very quickly opening up the lending facility that the Fed, working with the Treasury, so states that have cash flow issues can borrow. And as you know, with interest rates very, very low, states can borrow this money. Some of them would have to make changes because they do have balanced budgets. But this is a one-time situation that is quite different. But we'll be working with Congress to discuss these issues and many important issues like the liability issue. We want to make sure that if businesses open up, there's not frivolous lawsuits.
Mr. Secretary David Faber, but in listening to you answer that question, it sounds as like you don't view the state's fiscal problems as something that needs to be dealt with immediately. I mean, they are so many states facing significant shortfalls as a result of a fall in sales taxes. And it's not just New York, obviously, where the costs have been enormous, but the likes of Nevada or Florida or Louisiana, states that rely a lot on sales tax, they're facing big budget shortfalls that could require them, therefore, to lay off workers. Why isn't that something that you would view with immediacy that needs to be addressed?
Well, let me be clear that the CARES Act gave a lot of money to the states, and that money was intended not for lost revenues. It was intended for COVID-related issues, since that's really what the priority is. Having said that, we just gave them a lot more flexibility. So not only can they use it for direct COVID-related issues, but we've given them flexibility for first responders so that in no uncertain terms, the men and women who are out there helping us fight this terrible disease, the policemen, the firemen, the hospital workers, the first responders, we want to make sure in no uncertain terms they get laid off. Now, the issue of lost revenues is a complicated issue. These are taxing authorities on their own. Different states tax different ways. Some states have more issues. Some states have less issues. So this will be something that I continue to discuss with the president and we discuss with Congress.
Mr. Secretary, there's an opportunity here that you once said you would take on our show. Never thought it would happen. You said if we ever got negative interest rates, if we ever got interest rates so low, basically that the short term and the long term are the same, then you would not hesitate to refinance. What an unbelievable time to do just that. You could save trillions of dollars without having to raise any taxes at all. Why not take it? You understand the bond market better than anyone that's been in the government for a long time.
Well, Jim, we're absolutely doing that. So let me be clear. One of the things I've said is, one of the reasons I do feel comfortable with us spending all this money is because interest rates are very low, and we're taking advantage of long-term rates. I know at times we've talked about 50 years and 100 years, and when we looked at the market you know, there just wasn't as much demand as we thought. But right now we've launched the 20 years. So between 10 years, 20 years, and 30 years, we're borrowing an awful lot of money long term so that we can lock in this $3 trillion for a very, very long period of time. So we're being careful in balancing. We obviously don't want to disturb the markets too much, but we're going to take advantage of refinancing all of our debt to make sure that we have very low rates. And I think that's something that's a great opportunity for us.
Refinance existing debt where you would buy back debt, capital gain free, and then use these low rates to do that where you would save trillions more?
I don't think we need to buy back debt, Jim, just because of the amount of debt that we have that's short-term that does roll off and the amount of debt that we're using for these deficits. I think we have tremendous opportunities without needing to buy back debt. But I assure you, we are very much focused on low rates and taking advantage of locking this in for a long period of time.
Mr. Secretary, could you please tell the mortgage companies, look, we think that you ought to do mortgage forbearance, perhaps lengthen the what the mortgages are. There's some non-Fannie Mae paper out there that could lead to evictions. There are lots of retailers and restaurants that could be in a lot of trouble because they can't afford the rent. Real estate investment trusts in trouble. What a great opportunity to be able to say, you know what, guys, come on. This is a time for forbearance. This is the time where you must lose some money in order to be able to save our country.
Well, Jim, I completely agree with you. And during the mortgage crisis, the financial crisis, lenders worked with borrowers. I think Mark Calabria has done a great job at the FHFA working with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac on forbearance guidance. And the Secretary, Carson, has done a great job on Ginnie Mae and FHA. And we've encouraged private market lenders and banks to follow. Now, obviously, we're not going to tell them what to do because these are private contracts, but I think the majority of the banks are following these for their own portfolios. And on a lot of these loans, I think what they're doing is tacking on the payment to the end. So we understand that it's going to be hard for many borrowers to kind of make up two or three payments, so it'll get tacked on to the end. And we're monitoring the mortgage markets very carefully, so I'm quite pleased with how this is working.
Mr. Secretary, Jim brought up negative rates. The Journal, of course, over the weekend said the Fed is unlikely to use it. People predicting that Powell's appearance tomorrow will essentially say as much. Does Treasury agree?
Well, I want to be very careful. I am not going to comment on the Fed's action on interest rates. That's up to them, and that's consistent with my view. But I can assure you we have plenty of issuance at zero that we will take advantage of at those rates. So from my standpoint as being a borrower, we're going to take advantage of zero rates.
Speaking of the Fed, and it's David again, Mr. Secretary, where are we on the various programs that you were helping to backstop with what it was over $450 billion where you were going to take the first loss? Some of it was allocated. A lot remains unallocated, and it's not clear exactly how active the Fed has yet been on Main Street lending or aid to the states that you talked about in the form, of course, of credit. Give us an update here on what the Fed's doing and what your expectations are for those unallocated funds that came from Treasury.
I think the Fed and the team at Treasury has just done an outstanding job working round the clock, getting these facilities up and running. Several of them are up and running, as you said. There's several more that we expect that will be up and running over the next couple of weeks. We have literally daily calls with the Fed on the working teams working through this. And as you pointed out on purpose, I allocated half of the funds and I kept half of the funds in reserve since I don't know which one of these markets is going to need more money. So as opposed to allocating it out all in advance, I thought the strategic important thing is let's allocate a lot of money. Then we'll see where we need money. If we need to put more money in Main Street, we obviously have the ability to do that. As I said, on the corporate facility, we wanted to provide a lot of money there. My expectation is, in how the markets have opened up, we're going to need to spend a lot less money there. But I can tell you I'm authorizing a wire this morning going into the secondary corporate facility. It's on its way out. And we expect these facilities all to be up and running very quickly. And again, I just want to commend the amazing team of professionals at the Fed and at the Treasury who have been working round the clock to create these and market stability.
Mr. Secretary.
Is there one secretary that one of these programs that you think already the Fed has been most active in? You know, to your point, they haven't really had to intervene in the corporate bond market very much, it wouldn't seem, because it opened up simply on the prospect of them actually being involved.
Well, let me be clear. These facilities were supposed to be backstops. So this was intended to be backstops. So you saw the initial facilities around commercial paper and money markets took in some volume. Once we did that, it's quieted down. Again, it created stability in those markets. As I mentioned, the corporate bond markets, when we announced these, the corporate bond markets were completely stuck. They became unlocked. You look at the PPP facility, that's up and running, so small lenders are able to access the Fed facility. The Main Street facility, the Muni facility, we expect to be up and running soon. We're working on TELF. So, look, in the perfect world, we announce all these facilities, the markets work, and we don't need to use them. But they're there, and they're going to be ready, and they're going to serve as backstops. So we make sure that American business and American workers have access to liquidity.
Mr. Secretary, I keep hearing one word, and it's a word that people tell me you will not use, and it has to do with PPP. 75% goes to workers, but people want flexibility. They want not to give it. They want to give it to the workers, but kind of you go from law firm to law firm to law firm, business person, business person, business person. They don't know what to do. They need guidance, and they all want the program to succeed, but they don't know how to execute on it.
Jim, I disagree with you completely. They do know how to execute on it, and it's working great. 99% of the loans were $2 million and less to very small businesses. As you know, there's a small number of loans around public companies and things like that. But this program is working great. It's getting money to the workers. And on the 75%, let me just comment. The way Congress designed this, 8 weeks of payroll, plus 25% of overhead. If Congress wants to change that rule, I'm happy to work with Congress if there's bipartisan support to do that. But the 75% test was just a clarity on a test that was clear in the way that Congress designed this program. But again, like anything else, if we need to make technical fixes as we see different issues, I think one of the things we're particularly sympathetic to are the restaurants.
Yes.
Many of the restaurants are just beginning to open up and have said that, you know, they'd really like to hold the money. They can't do that. That's not something we can do, but we'll look at a technical fix. So we're working very clearly. But this program, let me tell you, this is going to help about 60 million Americans get back to work.
Mr. Secretary, I could not agree with you more. I think it's an unbelievable program. We just want there's certain industries that are more difficult, and if they give us flexibility from Congress, it will really be a home run. Secretary Mnuchin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Jim.
Great to talk to you.
Jim, thanks for bringing that to us. The opening bell this morning at the big board is Mark Castelnuovo, NYSE facility supervisor, and at the NASDAQ, a shot of the tower in Times Square. Great discussion, Jim, with the secretary, especially as it regards to corporate debt. You saw the UAL issue over the weekend didn't happen, reportedly because of concerns over collateral. But then Carnival gets upgraded this morning because they think that nobody wants their collateral, and as a result, they'll get a lot of waivers on covenants.
That was some. They say they have enough money. I think that maybe when you look at the timeline here, the key moment was when Boeing did not need a bailout. Boeing raised the money, and I think that was the Fed doing a great job. I know Treasury Secretary Mnuchin was very much involved, but that would have been the real disaster because that's the best industry we have. I think some of these less essential industries like cruise ships, it's amazing if they get the money. But you know what? I had Norwegian on Friday. They have almost no COVID. Everything's fine. And get this. You'll love this. David, in particular, because I know you're a big cruise fan. Bookings are ahead of last year. They're ahead of last year. So, David, you and I, come on. With the wives, what do you say?
Okay. I'll see you. Yeah. No, I don't think so.
No.
Maybe one of the small, really small boats, Jim, like the one that would just be the, you know, us and the crew. Maybe that one.
Yeah,
that
would Boston
work for me. Well, USS, we're not talking USS Minnow.
I was thinking more like maybe Geffen's boat. Does he lend that out at all?
I don't know, but it was great to see the upgrade, if only because it looks like that when you try to figure out what's going on with the stock market, not today, there is a hope springs eternal that is springing. And one of the reasons I was trying to work so hard with Secretary Mnuchin is, how do you have your Treasury Secretary basically say a number that will be worse than the Great Depression? I think that's where you want to hold the line. I think that's the hold. That's the Braveheart moment. You don't want to go worse than the Great Depression. It's really vital that we don't, because psychologically, I think it's very hard to come back.
Yeah, that Tudor Jones on Squawk did say that in terms of New York City, if we're looking at lockdowns like the one we have a year from now, he said that in that case, you would be talking about something resembling a depression. There's the heat map, Jim.
Right.
So many individual issues to get to. Intel's leading the Dow. I guess on these reports, I don't know, about the government holding talks with them and Taiwan Semi trying to repatriate some at least production of microelectronics.
It's interesting because Intel's not a great foundry maker. TSMC's unbelievable, and they have so much of the business. What matters to me is that we have Lam Research, we have Applied Materials, KLA Tencor. They're American companies. When you go into one of these plants, that's what you see. I tried to provoke Becky into provoking Navarro about the idea of trying to make it so Taiwan is protected more, because obviously it's a disputed area, but that's where most of this stuff is from. I think it's really kind of crazy that Intel's leader on this, because it's not really necessarily good for Intel. So unless there's a sovereign wealth fund, Intel is once again not a leader. It's a laggard. And let's not forget that other companies have passed them. Other companies like NVIDIA and AMD, which have been able to make much more precise, smaller footprints chips. So I don't know. I don't want to buy those stocks on that. I think that's a mistake. Brooke, I'm as big exposure to China, by the way, so that could be down. That Paul Tudor Jones interview is incredible because there really is, when you're trying to do a restaurant, and recently, not my restaurants, whatever, we're doing some takeout, but it's no one can do it. You have to take out too many tables. It looks like that you have to have tables every 6 feet, no table bigger than six, no bar to start, and you have to ask people, well, have you been in touch with COVID, and then you have to take their temperature. I mean, by the time you do that, give me Grubhub.
I know. His remarks were powerful, and they did seem to reflect, I think, you know, obviously as a lifelong New Yorker myself, the problems that New York conceivably will face, Jim, that we talk about in terms of what a return to normalcy will really look like before there's a vaccine. When you think about places that have large cultural institutions that rely on museums, on people going to the theater, on people going to Lincoln Center, and so many other things, not to mention just aggregate, bringing people together. It's hard to imagine the city returning to any sense of normal until, as you've said so many times, there really is a vaccine.
We're a city based on crowds. We're pro-crowd. We want a crowd in the theater. We want a crowd when we go to the museum. We want a crowd when we go out to dinner. Any restaurateur will say that. And that's antithetical. I don't know what's going to happen, but Paul Tudor Jones, what was he talking about, more than a million jobs. It could be 2 million jobs. I mean, what can open in this environment? It's because everything's small, but the crowds are large. So what do we do at every other row at the theater? Well, what play can survive at every other row? They need to pack them in order to be able to have a successful play. I mean, it is a Netflix Grubhub economy in New York, and I think it's a shame. I don't know any other way around it, though.
Yeah. No, well, listen, not to mention so many of the companies. Sorry, go ahead, Carl.
And I was going to say, I mean, on that point, David, regarding movie theaters, I mean, I don't know. Are we putting any faith in this Daily Mail headline about Amazon being interested in AMC, which is up 45% right now?
I don't know, Carl. I mean, I would point out, as we have in our past years together, of course, the Daily Mail, be very careful. I'm not quite sure what the benefit to Amazon would be. I almost could see them buying AMC Networks before I could see them buying AMC, the movie theater chain. So I will just reserve judgment on that story. Of course, remember, it was Dalian Wanda that owned that or bought a large stake in AMC and paying a great deal for it. They've got some issues. We know that. Adam Aron, of course, running that company, given their indebtedness as well. And that's a key point of everything going on right now, is if you've come into this crisis with a lot of leverage on your balance sheet, you really need to figure out what to do about it, which gets me to one of the larger deals, guys, that we've seen in some time and today, certainly in private equity. It brings together two of these trends, a levered company and private equity looking for an opportunity. I'm talking about Coty, the beauty company, which has reached this very important deal with KKR, in which KKR is going to buy $750 million of a convertible preferred with a 9% coupon right away to help them in terms of where they stand with liquidity and shoring up their balance sheet, but then also entering into an agreement, memorandum of understanding right now, but I am told that they are going to get to a definitive agreement fairly shortly, to sell 60% of their professional beauty and retail hair businesses. That includes Wella, Clairol, OPI. As you might imagine, given salons have been closed, that business has been suffering. They did come in down 20% overall in revenues at Coty for the third quarter. KKR is going to basically put in another $250 million to the convertible preferred at the same rate when they close that deal, and then buy 60% of a $4.3 billion enterprise value business. They're valuing it at roughly 12 times 2019 EBITDA. Of course, this year's EBITDA is not going to be anywhere near what last year's was. They're going to own 60% of it, get two board seats. So the check, Jim, from KKR is approaching $3 billion, 60% of a $4.3 billion enterprise value. Remember, that includes debt. And then another billion for the convertible preferred. That's a big number coming from, I think, two main funds at KKR.
I was shocked. I mean, these have been what we call football products, the Wella products. You go to Amazon, I mean, you're not going to get any price for these things. There isn't really necessarily anything that's proprietary. I don't know what KKR is thinking. They're smart people. But, boy, I hate to sell anything that goes into a Walgreens where that can be sold on Amazon, unless it's Clorox.
Well, as these are the professional businesses, you're right. They bought a lot of these from P&G, I think about 4 years ago, 4 or 5 years ago at Coty. They added a lot of debt. They are controlled by JAB, remember. Stock is up about 8%, getting closer and closer to the conversion price. It was about a 20% conversion premium, $6.24 for KKR's convert, and the stock is now $5.61. But these are the kinds of deals that you are seeing private equity step into. Remember, Coty had already had some issues with its balance sheet, was looking to sell the entire professional beauty line prior to COVID hitting. The process was ongoing, and it obviously changed a bit here towards the end as they move quickly to secure financing.
Yeah, I think that it's amazing to see any deals at all. I mean, who the heck knows what's going to happen the next day? I was cheered by that because what it says is that people think that there are certain stocks that have gone down so much that they want to take advantage of it. I don't know whether Adam Aron wants to sell AMC down here, but wow, Wella. I mean, just one of those things that has 5 feet in the drugstore and no one's really going to the drugstore. I don't know. I mean, if that's a deal, we got some other deals that are probably going to be working, David. Looks like you're going to have a busy summer after all.
You could be, Carl. There is starting to, I'm starting to sense a pulse in M&A. Just slight, very slight, but there is something there.
How about, Carl, yeah, we've got a lot of tests. Abbott's got a new test.
We had Liberty.
Quidel's
the new test out of Abbott. Got emergency use authorization from the FDA. That's a 15. Well, the Quidel is a 15-minute result thing, which I think Gottlieb had some kind words for, Jim. So yeah. Diagnostics and therapeutics, we are not going to take our eye off of that ball.
That's how you open America. You open America by knowing that you're feeling as good as you feel. Obviously, this disease is so insidious that it has these days where you're good, where you're the super spreader. And then as these days where your oxygen falls apart and you're dead. And anything that tells you that this could be happening is self-quarantine. And we really get things open. I don't know if we give badges to people who have gone through it or tested. But I read these things and I think, well, you know what? There is progress. It just seems to be disparate. Oh, Abbott, Quidel, who knew? Who knows? I don't know. Who knows working on what? I mean, is everybody? I have Bristol Myers Squibb as part of our one of our healthcare programs, and I want to ask them: do you have a secret project going on? Everybody seems to have something secret going on. It's great.
Yeah, we're off the initial lows, guys. Dow's down 180. Let's check in with Bob Pisani on this Monday morning. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning, Carl. Happy Monday, everybody. A bit of a defensive tone to the market today. So Pfizer, United Health, Johnson & Johnson, all up in the Dow. Cyclical stocks like Boeing, for example, JP Morgan, a bit on the downside. But still, the focus still is on the recovery rather than on the losses that we've had. The market's still acting very glass half fully. So here you see today, banks a little bit weaker, materials, industrials, there's your cyclical group a little bit weaker, where healthcare and consumer staples, there's your defensive group a little bit stronger. You get this push and pull. This is a very typical pattern. But generally, market's been glass half full rather than glass half empty. We like to remind everybody every day how difficult it is to figure out what the right levels for stocks are because so many companies are pulling guidance. And again today, smaller groups because earnings season is passing, but Chesapeake, Roku didn't give any guidance. Continental Resources, Blue Rock, some of the REITs haven't at all. Hamilton Beach Brands, all. We are nearing 40% of the S&P 500 that has declined to provide full year guidance, nearly 40%. That is unprecedented in history. Still, the focus remains on the recovery, as I mentioned, rather than on the losses. It's still glass half full. So if you look at the market internals, very clear where we are here. The S&P 500's regained 60% of the losses from the February 19th high. That's amazing rally here. The breadth has been expanding. That means more advancing stocks than declining stocks on a daily, weekly basis overall. And the volatility, well, the VIX is close 28 on Friday. That's the lowest level since February 26th. We were over 80, remember, in that week of March 23rd. Still, everybody keeps insisting we need to be cautious, and the internals of what we're seeing here certainly would recommend that. Other than no guidance from the S&P, the dividend cuts, we've seen suspensions, we've seen far fewer buybacks, although they're concentrated in a few areas, the reductions, and a notable multiple expansion in the S&P. We don't know what that means, but we're trading, depending on what quarter you're using for the future, 20 to 23 times forward earnings. That's a very, very high number, given the caution that's been out there. People keep saying, why is the market up with such horrible numbers? It was the big issue over the weekend. But look at the sectors. The sectors are telling you it's not so clear. The cyclical names, the banks, the energies, the industrials, the REITs, they're all still getting clobbered. This is from the February 19th high. Banks are still 34% below those old highs. That's hardly a recovery. Now, yes, we've seen some sector outperformers. Most of them tend to be in the defensive groups. So, for example, consumer staples and healthcare. Healthcare is only 5% off of its highs right now. And yes, this communication services have done very well, but that's because Alphabet and Facebook and Netflix and maybe Verizon have done really well. A small handful of stocks there. It's the tech group that's done really well. If you take a look at all of those names and see what they've been doing here, let me just show you the mega cap rally and show you where the biggest names, the five biggest names are from their 52-week highs. Microsoft is almost at a new high, 3%. Amazon's just off 3% off its new highs. Facebook and Apple are only 5% off their new highs. Alphabet's sort of the laggard. That's 9%. But remember, the S&P 500 is only 9% off of its highs. So those mega cap stocks have really been moving it. Those are in technology and communication services. The rest of the market, though, is still struggling. So let's make sure, David, that there is a bifurcation in the market. It's people haven't lost their minds. There is some rationality in the way the stocks are being priced. Guys, back to you.
All right, Bob, thank you. Bob Bassani, of course, who is down in Pennsylvania right now, but is somebody who I rely on to a certain extent to help navigate New York's amazing restaurants. We were talking earlier about, of course, the idea of New York, when it will get back to business. And on Squawk Box this morning, Paul Tudor Jones, the man who founded the Robin Hood organization, which has been so vital in terms of helping underprivileged New Yorkers in so many different areas for decades now, spoke very powerfully about his hopes for being able to aid all those people through the years in various jobs at New York who have helped him.
I'm thinking, okay, this is my chance to serve them. This is my chance to be of service to them, to try to equalize the ledger. And I want to be able to say in 20 years, to my grandchildren, that when they ask me, what did I do in the Second Depression, I want to look them in the eye and I want to tell them I did more than I ever thought I could do. I think that's the measure.
Okay. Guys, there sometimes seems to be a desire in certain parts to vilify some of our business leaders. Mr. Tudor Jones has been so instrumental in helping the lives of so many New Yorkers for so long. Of course, I know you guys have been supporters of Robin Hood, as have I, for so many years now. Tonight, we're going to be airing their what would typically be their annual gala, of course, usually takes place at the Javits Center. But he's a guy who has always been on the front lines in trying to make the world a better place.
Yeah, he's an angel. I mean, what can I say? I remember he came up to me and my wife, and he just said, "You're the greatest, blah, 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 blah." And my wife said, "Who is that?" I said, "That's an angel. That's a person who makes everybody feel terrific. He wants everybody to help." And I don't know. I mean, I remember when he had a big, big hit in the market, and so many others did, and there's some great people out there. He is the most self-effacing, terrific guy. If when you meet him in person, you would think, well, I don't know, what's this guy do? I mean, he seems like a good guy. The only word I can come up for him is angel.
Yeah, the numbers, guys, that he's been able to put together over the years, astounding, and we're rooting for them to do just as well tonight as it airs on CNBC and all kinds of other networks. Interesting, too, Jim, his discussion about the United States and socially how we may differ from other economies that have tried to tackle this problem differently. And then, of course, his comments on Bitcoin, which we had seen headlines about last week, but which he called more of a great speculation than anything else, with about 1 to 2%.
Right. He's seen it all. People want to go for it. He's so non-judgmental. He really is. I mean, what a lesson in life to listen to him. He does not have he doesn't have a firm line. I mean, if you likes to do something and it doesn't hurt him or hurt the country, game on. So many people are judgmental when they come on TV, and it's a shame because this guy's a peacemaker. I never even knew whether he's Republican or Democrat or whether he's hard line, soft line. Is he hard money, soft money? He's health and wisdom for society. Maybe that's how we have to be. I mean, I always feel great when he's on. He's sensational.
Yeah. Guys, 29-12 on the S&P. Let's check in with Rick Santelli on this Monday as well. Hey, Rick.
Good morning, Carl. You know, when I look at the fixed income markets, it's hard, of course, not to think of A, we have some big supply coming today. $96 billion in threes, tens, and thirties. This package is at record May refunding size. Today we'll start out with $42 billion in three-year notes. 1 o'clock Eastern, I will be covering this auction. Many will be scrutinizing to see how supply moves through the system. We all know United Airlines, of course, pulled a junk deal on Friday. There's others coming behind them like Viking Cruises. We're all going to monitor this, but it didn't seem to be an issue with the markets. Seemed to be more of an issue about their collateral, in this case, airplanes and the condition and the amount of them that would secure this loan, or at least in the eyes of the investors. So we'll watch and see. If you look at 1 week and twos, you can see we're down to 10 basis points intraday on Friday. Of course, it's never been down at that level. It settled at 14, the lowest yield close ever. And that's exactly where it's hovering right now for the most part. If you look at 1 week of tens further down the curve, you can see that we've come off our worst levels. But our worst levels at 60 basis points still is above 54 all-time forever low yield close. Tens minus twos thusly has steepened. It's moved basically from a low of 36 to 52. Steepening is good. Getting close to negative interest rates on the short end is not good. We certainly won't look to see if any Fed speak will address this really crazy, insane condition that has infected and affected Europe and Japan. And finally, let's look at what's going on with regard to the other part of the most important aspect of this. And this is what's going on with regard to the midpoints of tens minus twos. And not only that, but some of the other yield curve trades. If we look at the Bund at minus 52 basis points, it's right in the middle of its range, as many are kind of holding and idling to see how the greatest economy maybe delivers some of the Fed programs like the junk bond market this week. Carl, Jim, David, back to you.
A lot's coming our way in the next few sessions, Rick. Thanks, Rick Santelli. Take a quick break here as the Dow is red to start this week, coming off the first weekly gain in three, led by Intel, but Amex and Boeing dragging it lower. Back in a moment. Retail's at the center of the market weakness this morning. Under Armour's down 10% as sales fall 23%. You got Kimco in there as well, PVH, and some others. Although the Nasdaq's struggling to go green. We're back in just a moment. Let's get to Jim and stop trading.
Some companies you really root for, Arne Sorenson, Marriott. I know I do. Arne's fantastic. He reports a quarter, and Arne chooses words that he doesn't mince any words. Says a lot of stuff is just plain bad. Greater China is stabilizing, but at a level that is low. And it appears that lodging demand in most of the rest of the world has stabilized, albeit at very low levels. So the stock's getting hit. I have faith, but this is one that is still a very troubled area, hotels. Very troubled.
Yeah. Occupancy stabilizing in the low 20s, Jim. It's remarkable.
How is that
One
business?
Thing we didn't get to, yeah. One thing we didn't get to much on was AutoNation, Tesla, Toyota with some numbers about production rates as they start to reopen. Actually, a lot of manufacturers are going to be reopening in the coming days.
Yeah, Otto Jackson acquitted himself very well. Those were good, good numbers. Tesla, I like the idea that Musk says they have to work it out, but that Musk is actually arguing for, I think, a very, very reasonable stand. We saw that number, Toyota, just check in Phil LeBeau's excellent tweet column. But what would happen if Musk said, I'm moving to Mexico? Jeez, what a firestorm that would be, huh?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. Although, and then some of the China data on Model 3s down 64 in April is coming from the China Passenger Car Association. So we'll watch all of that.
Yeah.
How about tonight,
Alameda County? That's who's stopping Musk. I mean, you know, geez, I think a lot of people feel that it's out of control out there.
Yeah. Bristol Myers tonight.
Bristol Myers is part of my the healthcare initiative that we do here, and I've got to tell you that he's doing incredibly well now that deal with Celgene closed. Upwork, which is a way that freelancers get jobs, a live person, no longer are you going to be stuck. If everybody uses live person, it's going to be by messenger, so you don't get on hold for hours, which is what everybody's finding, particularly with people working at home. And and then American Electric Power had horrible numbers in industrial. The industrial decline's amazing. The stock got hit. You usually don't ever expect a utility to get hit, but this is those are depression numbers that he reported.
You've been listening to the opening bell on CNBC's Squawk on the Street.